Twisted Sisters Crime will contain mature content, graphic descriptions, and violence.
Listener discretion is advised. This podcast may upset trauma survivors.
Hello, welcome to bloody episode 6.
I can't with you sometimes.
Today we're headed back overseas to discuss crimes in England.
Aubrey, do you want to go over our stats?
Yeah, so according to Statista.com, there is a rate of 102.8 per 1,000 population in England and Wales. From September 2019 to September 2020, there were 698 homicides. Other data was hard to find because of the COVID-19 pandemic and lack of data that they had on that website, so that's all I could find.
Awesome. So if you guys want to go to our Facebook and Instagram pages, go on to TwistedSistersCrime.com, where you can also find the episode notes and sources.
So we don't have much more to start with for today, so let's just get started and hear from Crystal.
Awesome. I'm excited for today's story. A kind of sad story.
I mean, all stories about people getting killed are sad.
True. This is going to be another one about a little boy. I don't know why I keep finding things about little boys.
Because we're masochists.
Because maybe I have a son, and so I just, like, get drawn to them and how sad their stories are.
Yeah.
Because I would be devastated if that ever happened to my son. So we're going to go back into 1993. We have 10-year-olds Robert Thompson and John Venables. They abducted, tortured, and killed a 2-year-old boy from Kirby, England. His name was James Bulger on Friday, February 12th, 1993. The boys carefully selected James, took his hand while his mother wasn't looking, while him and his mother were shopping at the New Strand Shopping Center in England. James's mother had looked away for a second to pay the butcher for the pork chops she was buying, a moment she would regret for the rest of her life. The boys Robert and John had a fun, small little shoplifting spree. They stole a can of blue paint, some batteries, and other odds and ends from this mall. But they soon got bored of that, so they watched James and his mother for a little while before they took him. CCTV has evidence taken from the shopping mall, and it has the boys taking the odds and ends, which were later found at the crime scene. One of the boys also later admitted to finding a child and wanting to push them into oncoming traffic.
What is wrong with these children?
So that was like their main goal, was after
to just kill someone?
And yeah, they did want to steal a little boy or a little child and push them into oncoming traffic.
Oh, kind of sad. Oh my gosh, these kids are 10?
Yeah.
And they're like, let's go kill somebody today.
Yep. The moment when James was taken also was caught on CCTV around 1542. James was taken to the Leeds and Liverpool Canal. That was about a quarter of a mile from the shopping mall, where he was then dropped on his head and suffered injuries to his face. They do have an eyewitness that said during the trial he'd seen James crying his eyes out, quoted, but he didn't know what was going on. I did read that this eyewitness did stop the boys and ask what was the problem, but they had said that James was just their little brother and he was sad. So that's kind of crazy story.
You hear stories like this because it's such a human thing to want to help,
right?
But then it's like, oh, you're just, okay, like, I don't want to bother you. And it's like, at what point do you believe and not believe?
Right.
It's so hard. Like the Elizabeth Smart story where the officer tries to get her to take her veil off to see her face. And they're like, we can't do that for religious reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, you can't be like, oh, I don't care, take it off. But at the same time, they could have stopped it.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
During a 2.5-mile radius, there was a total of 38 people who had seen the boys. But all of these bystanders did nothing to intervene with the situation. The boys had arrived at the village of Walton, where they led James up a steep to a railway, where they began torturing him. At the train tracks, the boys showed no mercy for James at all. The boys had stripped him, removed his shoes, socks, and trousers before beating the life out of him. One of the boys also had thrown blue paint into James's left eye.
My bros.
Yeah. Robert and John had even stomped, kicked, and threw rocks and bricks at the poor little boy. The boys had put stolen batteries in James's mouth. The forensic pathologist also stated he believed that the batteries were also placed in his anus, and his foreskin had been forcibly pulled back.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, these 10-year-olds didn't. They have no...
They have no remorse. They I mean, I don't want to say it, but they have to be psychopaths. There's no way that they would do all this.
I know. Robert and John were not just done there. They had finally dropped a 22-pound bar, which I found was a railway fish plate, on his head. So if you don't know what a railway fish plate is, I do have pictures that we'll put on our website just so you can kind of reference what it looks like. But yeah, James had not died from all of this, and the boys placed James on the railway track with stones on his head in hopes that the train would finish the job.
Are you kidding?
And hope that his death would look like an accident. So these boys to have known maybe something. I don't know if they like watched movies that showed violence like this or... And I didn't find very much on their background either. So...
Well, this was what? 1993?
Yeah.
That's just...
James's body was found 2 days later, and the nation was shocked. The police did spring into action, and soon after, the CCTV footage was found of James leaving the shopping center with a youth and another youth, quoted by the police, walking in front. The police thought the boys were teenagers. The photo was released in hopes of the public's help. Now, fortunately, one woman did recognize John and contacted the police. The boys were arrested very soon after this woman recognized them. The fact that the boys were so young came to a shock to the investigators. Forensic tests did confirm that both Robert and John had the same blue paint on their clothes as found on James. Both had blood on their shoes. The blood that was on Robert's shoes was a match to James, and the pattern found on James's cheek matched that of Robert's shoe. A paint mark in the toe cap of John's shoe meant that he had to have used a lot of force when he had kicked James. The boys were charged with murder on February 20th, 1993. The boys were also named as Child A, Robert, and Child B, John, to protect their identities from public. John and Robert were tried as adults. There were up to 500 protesters gathered at the boys' trial, and the parents of the boys had moved to different parts of the country and also assumed new identities following death threats that they got. In court on October 1st, 1993, the boys did deny all charges of the murder and abduction. At the trial, prosecution counselor Richard Henriquez successfully rebutted the principle of dolly impactex. I don't know if I said that right, but it presumes that any young child should not be legally responsible for their actions. Right?
I mean, yeah, but you steal a kid and beat him up and leave him on the train tracks to die. I think you know what you're doing.
I would think so, too.
But okay.
Robert was considered to have taken the lead role in the abduction process, though it was John who had apparently initiated the idea of taking James to the railway. John later described how James seemed to like him. He was holding his hand and allowing to pick him up on the journey to the scene of his murder.
That's terrible. And they still freaking did it?
Yeah. The boys, by then aged 11, were found guilty of James's murder. At the Preston court on November 24th, 1993, they did become the youngest convicted murderers of the 20th century. In 1999, lawyers for John and Robert appealed to the European Court of Human Rights that the boys' trial had not been impartial, since they were too young to follow proceedings and understand adult court. In June of 2001, after 6 month review, the parole board did rule the boys were no longer a threat to public safety and could be released as their minimum tariff had expired in February of that year.
What? That's like eight years.
Yep. So they were released a few weeks later on a lifelong license after serving only 8 years. Both the boys were given new identities, and they did move to secret location under a kind of eyewitness protection style program. This was supported by the fabrication of passports, national insurance numbers, qualification certifications, and medical records. So pretty much every aspect of their life just
was changed.
It flipped. They're no longer these two people. More terms of their release included they were not allowed to contact each other or James's family. Curfews may be imposed on them, and they must report to probation officers. Now, if they breached the rules or were deemed a risk to the public, they could be returned to prison. So, I found a little bit about these boys now. So we have John Venables. He did receive a new identity upon his release at the age of 18. However, since then, it's been changed twice as he both disclosed his real identity to friends and had leaked it to the public, basically.
My dude.
That he was the one who had killed this little boy.
Okay, the whole purpose of changing your name was so that no one would know who you were because you were receiving death threats.
Yep. So they did.
Oh my gosh.
They did have to change his identity again. In 2012, he was sent back to prison for possessing indecent images of children. Following his release in 2013, he was recalled to prison in 2017 and is currently serving a 40-month sentence right now.
Thank the Lord.
So John could be in prison right now. But I can't do any more research on him.
Because I keep changing
my name. Because he has to keep changing his name and his real identity needs to be secret. So we do have Robert Thompson, the other little boy in this case. He is 36 years old. He has not reoffended since being released on this license when he was 18 years old. In 2006, reports did claim that he was in a stable gay relationship. And he looks like he got into it at about age 23. He has settled into his local community in the Northwest. It is believed Robert remains in a long-term relationship with a man who does know his real identity. But then again, his identity is protected by a worldwide injunction, meaning that even if I or you were to try out and find out where he lives, it could land us all in jail. So
don't try and find out.
Try and find out who he is or where he is. Same with John Venables. That would just be a bad situation for all of us.
If that's true that he's in a relationship, could you imagine your significant partner being like, I just want you to know, when I was 10, I brutally murdered this kid. Brutally.
I think I did state earlier that he was the one who kind of took the lead role in this. Mm-hmm. But I do feel like after serving his 8 years, he's not a good person, no. But I do feel like he had changed a little
in this situation. He actually got reformed.
And he actually got the help that he needed for this situation. As for John, I could definitely say the opposite. He hasn't learned his lesson. John still
needs the help.
Yeah, he still looks at children and is in prison again. But yeah, just don't do research on them and try and find out where they live. I know you guys think, just like I thought, we could be sneaky. But reading this injunction about their identities, we do need to keep that private. And we need to at least respect that.
That's dark.
That is dark. Very dark.
My story is recent, but short. It's interesting because we both switched our stories. So we can come back to England because we both have other stories that we've already looked into. But so I'm going to talk about Sarah Everard. She grew up in the Heslington area of York. She was the youngest in her family, having two older siblings. Her father's name is Jeremy, and he works as a professor. Her mother's name is Sue, and she works for charity. So Sarah moved to London after college, and she started working in marketing and public relations. In 2020, just like all of us, her year just went to crap. She lost her job, and her long-term relationship got cracked. However, she did stay positive throughout the whole pandemic, and continued to do online exercise classes and supported her friends as they too struggled during the pandemic. Does any of this sound familiar? I bet all of us know a Sarah. All of us have a girl in our life that is a rock for us. As she's described by her family, she's bright, beautiful, a wonderful daughter and sister, always putting others first and having the most amazing sense of humor. A strong and principled shining example for us all. As her head teacher, Steve Lewis, defines her, her joy, intelligence, and positive spirit shine within the school. As Rose Woolard, hope I said that right, explains, exceptional friend, dropping everything to be there to support her friends. And as Helena Reason portrays her, smart, talented, a person with a beautiful soul. And then finally, as Holly Morgan recounts, a sunshine, light, and someone that made you feel warm and good inside. So Sarah was at her friend's house on March 3rd. Around 9 p.m., she left and started walking home, a trek that should have taken her no more than 50 minutes. She was wearing bright clothes on her way home, told her friend she would text her when she got home, and she was on the phone with her boyfriend, Josh Louth, for 15 minutes until her battery either died or got switched off. She was shown on CCTV footage walking along the A205 road towards Tulse Hill. When her call with Josh ended, no one heard from her again. So March 10th, her remains were found in Ashford, Kent, in a builder's bag, and through dental records, they were identified to be Sarah's. Ashford is about an hour and a half drive from London. Divers and searchers are still looking around the area to find more evidence, including her phone. She has been giving a post-mortem examination, but so far, as of the recording of this episode, no cause of death has been given out. So on March 9th, Wayne Cousins was first arrested for a complaint of indecent exposure 3 days before Sarah's disappearance. He was accused of showing his genitals to a woman at a fast food restaurant. Once Sarah's body was found, police revealed that he is also charged under suspicion of her kidnapping and murder. His wife, whose name I could not find, was also arrested in suspicion of being connected, but she was released on bail. Wayne Cousins is also a 48-year-old serving police officer. He was in charge of monitoring security at Downing Street, where the Prime Minister, Parliament, and other political figures reside. And on Google Maps, Downing Street is about a 20-minute drive from where Sarah was last seen. Although, according to the police, he was not working at the time of her disappearance. While he was in custody, he did receive a head injury that he had to be treated for before his hearing on March 13th. On the 13th, he went to the Westminster Magistrates Court and only spoke to confirm his name and date of birth. So far, his plea hearing is set for July 9th, and his trial is set to begin October. The Crown is super behind on all of their cases right now because of the pandemic. So that is why his trial and his plea hearing is so far out, and why those dates may possibly change. So kind of interesting, we both are going to have protesters in ours. So since Sarah has gone missing, social media has been obsessed with her. Jamie Klinger of Reclaim These Streets had organized a protest that she then had to cancel because of the pandemic. Her and others from the Reclaim These Streets organization then started the vigil for Sarah that is a flower memorial setup. Rothna Begum, I'm so sorry if I said that wrong, but she is a senior woman and human rights researcher. She states that the reason the killing of Sarah is so shocking is that it could have been any one of us, which is true, and it's sad, but you know, it is true. So protests have been organized and canceled because of COVID, but people have still showed up, resulting in many arrests for unlawful gathering, including this student, Patsy Stevenson. Patsy states she was unaware of the protest and showed up at the flower memorial made for Sarah to just place a candle for her. She saw that there were a lot of women there and got concerned that the police were being too rough, and so she went to move flowers to create more room. As she was standing with the other woman there, she was forced to the ground and arrested, and then charged £200 for being there. Kate Middleton was also seen attending the makeshift flower memorial. Just a fun little fact about that. And here's some crazy stats. In the UK, on average, a woman is killed every 3 days by a man. Annually, 87,000 people in the world are killed by men. And these facts and other women's stories have been shared all over social media in response to Sarah's death, and the idea that even after doing everything that we are told is right to do, such as walking, wearing bright colors, having a weapon, being on the phone, any of that is even required for women to protect ourselves at night. Some women have even fantasized what they would do in a world without men for 24 hours and shared such mundane dreams such as going on a run outside with both headphones in. And so in light of these events, Parliament, England, and Wales are going to start experimentally recording misogyny as a hate crime starting in the fall of this year. And as of this recording, this is all the information I was able to find. And that's because this case is barely 2.5 weeks old, but we will be keeping an eye on it and updating you as we can.
I think that's cool that, like, Kate Middleton, like, famous people are getting the word of this disappearance and her murder.
Yeah.
And
it's just crazy, like, so you guys can go onto Twitter and TikTok and all that and just, like, see all the reactions people have had and just, like, it's just crazy. These other women's stories. And the fact that every 3 days someone's killed in the UK by a man, like, it's just, it's crazy. And, like, yeah, like, men get killed too, and there's crazy stuff about that, but it's just, you know, misogyny isn't apparently a hate crime, and that's a problem.
Right.
You know, we're told, you know, we literally have tasers and maces and all this made for us so that we can be protected, and it's like, it's not our job to not get murdered.
The other sad thing about it is we have all this stuff to protect us, and that's still not gonna stop whoever it is from doing what they wanna do.
Well, that's what the big thing with hers is the like slogan is she was just walking home and, you know, she was wearing the clothes, she was on the phone, she didn't have a taser or anything with her, but she was walking from her friend's house, you know?
Right.
She did what she was supposed to, according to what we've been told, and still a police officer kidnapped her and killed her.
Yep.
And it's just annoying. So that's why I wanted to share hers, even though it's really recent, so there isn't a whole lot. I just thought it was really important because I personally, like, I saw, like, the Twitter moment, but I didn't, like, know what was happening. And so I think it's important we stay up to date on stuff like that.
Absolutely. Well, guys, we've had some crazy stories today. We hope you guys are liking the show so far. Please rate and comment on the episode and let us know what you guys think.
And feel free to also send us any cases you want to hear. We have some that have been suggested to us for when we return back to Utah, but we would love to hear what other cases you all are interested in.
So other than that, thanks for listening. Don't forget, guys, stay smart, stay safe, stay twisted.
Twisted, twisted.
Twisted, twisted.
Bob it.